Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly. I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But they love eating people. They love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic.
There'd be a lot of poop in my pants. I've seen a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Ain't it odd?
That a house of God looks like a facade for Trinidad squads proclaiming jihad.
Something happened there.
We're just saying, ain't it odd? Oh, I'm wearing that shirt.
Somewhere in the middle, you got all tripped up. Mm-hmm. I don't know, mini stroke.
It's texting a realtor.
Oh, all right. Things are happening.
Trying,
yeah.
I'm done with town life.
Yeah, I'm over it too, and I don't even live here.
You don't got to deal with 90% of the stuff.
That's true, yes.
I guess by proxy.
Yes, I hear enough.
Yeah.
I'm already over it.
You come out like, yeah.
I did live in town for almost a year once.
And you loved it. Oh, I'm the Great and Powerful Mystery.
Oh, and I'm Jay Clone 71.
Sorry, this is your first episode you're ever hearing.
Yes. Cold open.
Cold open. Ready for this episode?
Yeah. You said it's going to be a long one.
Yeah, it's maybe a two-parter, I think.
It's a dense one?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so buckle up, everyone. Dense episode incoming.
The Dyatlov Pass incident.
Oh, gosh. I thought it was... Is that how you say it? I always heard, like, Dyatlov.
I've heard Dyatlov.
Yeah.
Dyatlov and D-Love.
Okay, so Russia. Russia, right? Is that where this took place?
Yes, yeah. So I'm gonna go ahead and just go D-Love, just because it's easier for me to say.
That's fair.
The pronunciation, I believe it is correct, is Dyatlov.
Dyatlov? Yeah, I always said Dyatlov. Either way, that's the one we're talking about. If you don't know this story yet...
You're about to,
but it's a very famous, well, I don't know if you want to say Yeti, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or something else story.
It's a famous missing people, found people, dead people... story with oddness all around it.
With
from governments to Iron Curtains to blaming indigenous people.
And the photographs that may or may not be hoaxed.
The photo is real, the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Whether it's a Yeti or not, which we'll come back to that, is what people don't know.
Right.
Because it could be one of the skiers in a snowsuit.
Mm-hmm. But we'll get to that in this episode. Mm-hmm. So there's your foreshadowing.
Maybe the next part, but this is, I mean, it's a chunky thing.
All right. So I know little bits about this whole incident. I know, and we've talked about it from time to time.
Yeah, we brought it up. I mean, it's, if you're into this kind of stuff at all,
you know about
this one.
So I'm assuming we're going to get into the details.
Yeah, we're going to go over kind of the whole story, some of the evidences, who investigated what, and if they're credible or not.
Like, yeah.
This would have been during the Soviet Union. So credible or not, you know, is maybe a question.
What's that supposed to mean?
Well, it's just like the U.S. military government complex, industrial government complex, testing on U.S. civilians.
Oh, okay, yes.
The Soviet military was probably also doing the same thing.
Probably. All big governments are just evil.
Except that, well, I guess big government, yeah. There's that, is it Chile? The Chilean president?
Yeah.
Really lives in like a hut, takes no salary.
So, yeah, he seems nice.
You ever seen that?
I have not.
He like walks to work and everything like that. He doesn't have a car. He literally lives in like a shack the size of this room with his wife.
Nice.
And he gives all the money that he would get to like the local boys' school or something like that.
Hmm. Sounds like a decent human being.
I think he is, but I think it's Chile. It may not be. It's a South American president.
It could be. I don't know. We'll find out. If they have any resources, he'll be overthrown and 0.2 seconds.
I don't think they have any.
Okay. Well, apparently not if he's doing that.
He's living in a shack.
Yeah.
So one of the most bizarre, not to mention flat-out terrifying mysteries of the modern age concerns the deaths of 9 Russian mountaineers who were cross-country skiing but ended in tragedy so ghastly and so perplexing that it still mystifies experts over half a century later.
Mm-hmm.
This story, and we'll get into all of the possible explanations I could find, if not a myriad of more. I mean, Yetis are probably the least on the list of odd explanations.
Okay.
Excursions into nature can be serenic from exalting from others. Unfortunate few things, though, for these sojourns into untouched wilderness of our world can be very tragic. Still, other such journeys into the unknown and in such unfathomable, frightening circumstances that they're beyond the stuff of legend. There are people that, like, there's been a couple movies made about this and a couple books, you know, where the ending is, you know, it's the Yeti ending, it's the government experiments, it's the UFOs, it's...
Mm-hmm.
And people, there's a large group of people modern day that do not realize that this was a real event.
Right, okay.
That they think it's just...
stories.
Yeah.
Okay. No, yeah, it's just very much really happened.
Yeah. Such is the destiny that befell the 9 ill-fated skier enthusiasts in the late 1950s. Unlike so many of the most intriguing mysteries of the 20th century, including the fate of the crew of the Ork and Megan, or the whereabouts of the missing Anunnak village of Canada, what makes the so-called Delove Pass incident so fascinating is the fact that absolutely no doubt that these events actually occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this happened.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much evidence, so many people tied to it. The one skier, which we'll talk about, that got left behind, it's nuts.
It's actual canon. Mm-hmm. It's real life canon.
This dreadfully little doubt of none of the last sensation experience of the poor souls that had this terror upon them. The proof of this tragedy exists not only in the plethora of photographs that have been preserved, but also in the extensive records, many of which still allegedly classified, of the Soviet military who investigated the odd cases, and where manifests were unable to reach any definitive conclusion despite overwhelming amounts of physical evidence. In fact, the investigation tasked with solving the case would eventually force to attribute the whole peculiar affair to a compelling unknown force.
Wow. I just thought it's something really silly and dumb, though. Did that one, you say one person survived?
No, yes.
Okay.
So we'll get into, this was like a cross-country skiing, so they would stop in little towns and stuff like that.
Right.
The one guy got food poisoning, and he got bedridden. So instead of having the whole crew wait for him, he said, go ahead, and that was the net when they disappeared.
So he wasn't there for the actual incident.
Yeah, he was for the first half of the trip.
Gotcha, okay. Not when the occurrence happened.
Yeah, but it was literally, he left just before.
Okay.
So he was proof, and he was the one that started ringing the bells and stuff like that. Like,
something's wrong?
Yeah, they should be back.
Yeah.
Because there was a window of time they were supposed to be back.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fastest it could be was X date, they'll be back. Nobody be concerned though, unless it were past X date.
Right.
So a big window of time.
So once that passed.
I mean, yeah, so they, like, their families weren't very concerned or anything like that, even though, like, say they're supposed to be back February 4th. Then it's February 6th. They weren't very concerned because there's like a month window.
Okay.
Because if they stop, if it snows, you know, it's blizzard.
Yeah, you know. Don't know how where you could get hung up at mm-hmm. or how much delayed you could be. Yes.
Yeah. So the skiers on January 25th, 1959, one ski instructor, three engineers, and seven students from the former Soviet Union's Ural Polytechnic Institute, located in the city of Servizdes, boarded a train and embarked on a journey to the nearby Orton Mountains. They're nestled in the northern Urals. A strenuous cross-country skiing expedition. So this was a high-level skiing expedition.
Okay.
It had been done before, but it wasn't like it was a completely unknown ski trail.
Were they on like a excursion for like the university, like for like were they getting collecting stuff and?
No, it's just like they were all enthusiasts. Their teacher, couple engineers, and the students.
Okay.
So they were all ski enthusiasts, and they wanted to do this.
Okay, just a ski club, basically. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, like a ski club.
Something like that, okay.
The leader of the excursion was an enthusiastic 23-year-old man by the name of Igor D. Love.
Okay.
For whom the notorious pass would eventually be named after.
Okay.
Named after his corpse.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's really on, like, yay!
If you get, you know, turned inside out by lasers, you get a pass named after you.
Yeah, where you got turned inside out by lasers, yeah.
Who had assembled a crack team of male and female skiers with the intentions of this arduous trip that would serve as a training exercise for further expeditions in more difficult and treacherous Arctic regions. So a lot of them were working on getting, like, certified to guide these trips and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Like, in hardcore things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the first kind of big outliers for this case.
Okay.
Many of the students and the professor were either already certified to lead these courses or going to be certified to lead these courses.
Okay.
So this was like a training exercise for this group.
So it wasn't their first rodeo.
No.
Let's put it that way.
So it's like a group of, there's no novices.
Right.
There's no novices in this group. This trail is arduous, but it should not be undoable for this group.
Yes, they are all capable of doing this trail.
So as the group of seasoned skiers left the train and hopped on a truck heading towards their very own alpine in the Urals, one of the team members, Yuri Yadin, fell extremely ill and was forced to remain behind in the settlement of Vizeral, the last outpost before he got to the Orton Range.
Mm.
He says, hugged his comrades goodbye with envy and watched them leave. Scarcely could imagine that this time he would be the lucky one.
Hmm. Yeah, there's always a good time to get sick, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine that, feeling how bad he was probably feeling, of like, I'm missing this great thing. We planned this for half a year. You know, they're going to get certified. I'm missing out. And then, you know, a couple months later, they're all dead and they're turned inside out.
Hmm. Seems kind of fishy, if you ask me.
Glad I had the shrimp that night.
Yeah. Maybe he has a buddy he paid.
He's actually a Yeti in disguise.
Right, his buddy?
No, he.
Him? Yuri. Oh, it was just him?
Well, it was Yuri and his family.
Okay.
That's what he does. Every year goes out and lures him back.
He gets this ski trip together, mm-hmm. builds like a decade's worth of trust with him, gets him out there, and then feeds him to his family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good plan.
Later in life, Yuri would claim that one thing that had haunted him over the many, many years was he was not able to discover what kind of diabolical force stole the lives of his friends, a fate that he would have shared with them, whether or not for his unexpected illness. According to Yuri, he said, "If I had a chance to ask God just one question, it would be, what really happened to my friends that night?"
Hmm. That'd be a good question to ask.
And he was, I know we're joking a little bit and trying to,
make light of it a little bit.
He was extremely distraught over this.
Oh, I bet.
Yuri was the one that was ringing bells, wouldn't shut up, you know, was almost silenced by the government several times.
And I'm over here accusing him of doing
it. Yeah. He almost got iron curtained away a couple of times.
Gosh, okay.
Because he was like, no, these kids didn't die in an avalanche. These kids didn't fall down the mountain.
No. Well, we'll find out later, too, what was left behind and what happened.
So 2 days after embarking on their adventure, the 9 remaining athletes, including the engineer, Rustem, Georgie, and Nicholas, as well as a student, another student, so this is a different Yuri.
Okay.
Zendi, Ludomil, and the ski instructor guide, Alexander, all followed the Dilov towards the first stop in their long and grueling journey, the Gorgon Orton Mountain. The date was January 28th of 1959. The team would never make it to their destination, and none of them would ever be seen alive.
Mm-hmm.
So far, January 28th.
Okay.
When the date, stuff stopped moving.
Okay.
We're going to jump ahead a little bit. On February 11th, so about 12 days later.
Roughly, yeah.
The Dilov ski team was supposed to arrive in Zurich, along with the first orders of business following a hot meal and a stiff drink, or to send their loved ones telegrams announcing their success of their mission. So, yeah, that's the first date they were supposed to let everybody back home.
No.
Hey, we're still alive.
Okay.
Everything's fine. You know, that kind of stuff.
Right, yeah.
So that day comes and passes. No telegrams are received.
No letters.
Most of the team's family members were not concerned at all, though.
No.
Realizing the journeys like this rarely end on schedule, but when over a week went by with no word of the skiers, then relatives started to demand the Ural Polytechnical Institute organizer to organize a search and rescue operation, which they did post-haste. That's okay. The school.
Right, yep. The school they were all associated with. Yep.
So they waited about a week, and then everybody's like,
something needs to be done. Yep.
Well, like I said, though, because I've watched so much stuff on this and heard so many podcasts and everything, and some people like really blame the parents. Like, why is nobody freaking out? It's a wilderness hike. They know it. You know, there's a date range.
Right.
If everything goes perfect, we'll be back February 11th.
Right.
If, you know, it may be February 20th, we get back. So, they, you know, I don't know. It's just, to me, I don't blame the parents.
No, because they knew there was no reason to freak out until a certain date. Then they know something's afoot. Or at least you have reason to worry.
Yeah, to start being, okay, it's time to move. But, and then the school did it also.
Yeah, immediately.
When the parents called and like, hey, it's time,
mm-hmm.
The school started organizing stuff and moving. Within days, it became clear that the Institute's ground base would not be able to produce any results on their own, and they both military and civilian authorities would get involved in the search. So the university went out for a couple days, realized that we're not able to do this.
Right.
Like, this is way above what we can do, and these people need help. So they reached out to the military and other civilian organizations. The military planes and helicopters were swiftly dispatched to the area. And on February 25th, so we're getting to almost a full month after they went missing.
Right, yeah.
The pilot was first spotted something curious on a mountainside below. So pilot's flying almost a month later. They see just a little thing sitting on the mountainside that's out of place.
Okay.
So the pilot marks the coordinates of where it is. Because you can't land. It's the size of a mountain.
Right. Especially in a helicopter.
Oh, he's in a plane.
Oh, okay. Well, same, especially that, too. Even worse.
Yeah. So he marks where it is. So it took the next day, the search party, including the Polytechnical Institute students, made their way to the abandoned encampment on the eastern slope of the mountain listed as 1079.
Okay.
So this is the camp.
Okay. They found where they are, the hikers.
The foreboding peak is better known to the indigenous tribes as Culta Siculo, which translates into the native town or their native tongue, the Mountain of the Dead.
Hmm. Might be more to that name than, or it's not just a name, I'm assuming.
Yeah, like Ape Canyon.
You're right. Yeah. Interesting. Or the Valley of the Headless Men.
Devil's Nest.
Hmm.
You know, when native peoples are like, that's Bird Mountain. That's Deer Mountain. That's Mountain of the Dead.
Yeah.
What's that one? Oh, Deer Mountain?
Right, yeah. No, the one behind it.
Oh, the Mountain of the Dead.
Yeah.
You go up there, you explode.
Right, yeah.
And, oh, come on, dumb natives. Then you go up there, and you explode.
Huh. Funny.
Mm-hmm. Remember, on the Cryptid's Corn podcast, if the people that are native to the area tell you a thing, it's probably true.
Probably.
If they call the area, yeah, that's Sharp Tooth Valley. There's reasons.
I mean, that's hindsight now.
So the would-be rescuers discovered an extremely badly damaged tent and a plethora of footprints made by what appeared to be at least 8 different people radiating out of the devastated tent. Sarvin had discovered the state of a large tent in the skiers all shared. And here's a quote from him. "We discovered that the tent was half torn down and covered in snow. It was empty. The group's belongings and shoes were left behind."
Mm.
So this is already the first weird thing. The tent is in the middle of a snow slope.
Not where it normally should be set
they
up.
They would never, right. ever set a tent up in the middle of a snow slope.
Right.
They were all sharing one tent. What happened to the other tents?
Hmm.
Was it because they were scared and they wanted to all be in the same tent? Was it because it was so cold they needed to do it for warmth?
Right.
If it was cold, though, why wouldn't they set up in the woods on both sides of the slope?
Hmm.
So these are the first big questions. And there's more oddness with the tent, but we'll come back to that. Before I continue, I guess, I'm at a little bit of a stopping point. What are your thoughts so far?
I mean, everything seems to be going according to how it should have, you know, as far as timeline and a search and rescue and then where they actually found them. I mean, so far, nothing just seems odd besides the whole group going missing, you know? So, I mean, just kind of seems like a normal hiking group gone missing story.
Until right now.
Right. I know it gets crazier, but yeah, as of up to this point, nothing seems really out of the ordinary other than just the group gone missing.
Mm-hmm. So the search party members quickly realized that the tracks consisted of entirely bare or socked clad feet. So nobody had shoes except a single person that had a single shoe.
Hmm. So they were moving in haste.
The two sets of... So this is going to get complicated. So we'll try to do this together. Because it, even when I've watched this on TV, there's several really cool... Or not cool. There's several really well-done documentaries about this on TV.
Okay.
It gets confusing.
Okay.
Because after that, everybody was in the tent at this point, and then something happens. They cut their way... So that when they start analyzing the tent back at the school... The tent was cut from the inside with a knife, not from the outside. They didn't use the door. They cut the tent open to get out.
Well, let's get to that part of this.
So where the people all end up and everything is extremely weird and hard to follow.
Okay.
Even when you're watching like people like them show it.
You're watching recreations. Yes.
So, yeah. So two sets of prints led down the slope towards an extremely densely forested area. But the tracks were covered with with snow roughly 1,500 feet away from the tent. So they ran from this first two sets of tracks, ran straight down the slope to the deep woods for 1,500 feet, and then the tracks disappeared.
Gosh.
In the night, without shoes.
In the snow.
Mm-hmm. They also followed the trail and found the remains of a fire beneath a looming ancient pine, with something much worse. Near the long dead fire was the frozen remains of a team member's Duroxco and Kurvisco. That's last names.
Oh.
The searchers noted that the utter bewilderment that even though the men were all within range of the now ravaged tent before the men were naked and shoeless, save for their underwear. So these guys could still see the tent. These two men that were sitting around this fire they made in this ancient tree.
Mm-hmm.
They could still see the tent.
Mm-hmm.
They are sitting in the cold, in the snow, in their underwear.
Right.
They never went back to the tent.
Hmm. Hmm.
Their clothes and everything's right there.
Their corpses, they found their bodies?
Yeah,
there?
They basically froze to death. They died of exposure.
Wow. Okay.
So, something happened in the tent area for these two people.
To just go over there and sit.
Sit, made a fire, and froze to death.
Yeah.
Rather than going back 1,500 feet where their clothes, like you can see
right.
the tent where their clothes, their shoes, their coats.
Hmm.
Yeah. The investigators also saw the branches of the old pine had been snapped off at heights of almost 15 feet.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's okay.
Forensic tests later confirmed that traces of skin were found embedded in the bark, indicating that the pair had frantically attempted to climb the tree, snapping off branches until their hands were masses of pulpy flesh.
Oh, gosh.
A couple fingers had bone exposed.
From trying to climb.
From trying to climb in a panic in the blinding night.
That's insane. So I can't imagine whatever fear was going through them.
I mean, they're just slamming their bodies into trees, slamming their hands, and just gripping.
Right, yeah.
They made it about 15 feet up, and they kept falling down.
Gosh. Oh, that's so scary.
And there's, you can look at pictures of this tree. You can see, like, how it's bare all the way up.
Yeah.
It looks, it was people that did it, but it looks like an animal was just going nuts at this tree.
Yeah.
But it was two humans.
Going nuts at this tree.
There's pictures of their hands where they're just, they peeled the skin off. I'm trying to climb.
So scary.
So, at this point, the searchers had no doubt began to wonder what manner of beast could scare these men so much that they abandoned their clothes despite the freezing cold. They tore the skin from their palms in a desperate attempt to get to safety. The fact is there's no evidence of animal tracks. At that time, they had time to start a fire. Combined with the fact that the bodies of the men remained untouched, only heightened the searchers' puzzlement. So, after they calmed down, they sat at this tree, they made a fire, they're still within view of the tent. So if they were that scared or something,
right? They would have.
Why
been
did
further.
They sit there?
Yeah,
and start a fire.
Yeah.
Was it because it was pitch black and you could hear things moving around you?
Yeah.
Was it because their brains were fried?
Just yeah, couldn't go any further.
Whether it was an animal, nothing ate on them.
So they weren't killed by it.
They died of exposure.
Right. They didn't die by whatever ravaged their camp.
Yeah. Okay. And so first they're like, well, you know, maybe a rare bear. A bear would have, you know, eaten these guys' livers.
Oh, something, yeah.
Yeah.
Something. It would at least, or took a swipe at them. They would have been evidence of a bear being around them.
And they would have been, it'd be very, very rare for a bear to be awake.
Okay.
It's February.
Right,
or January when this happened.
Well, and they would have seen.
Not saying it's impossible for a brown bear to be up.
Right, but unlikely.
It'd be very rare.
And they would have found blood like all over, or
bears don't kill very cleanly.
No, or big giant tracks like footprints or print, you know, bear prints, whatever. All that would have been evident and
so
made note of.
Not long after the party, the search party had found the bodies of these two men. They stumbled across the corpse of the team leader, DeLove himself, nearly 900 feet away from the other corpses, but somewhat closer to the tent.
Mm.
So the tent's in the middle of the snow pass. The two first men we talked about were straight down into the woods, 1,500 feet. He's 900 feet away from them, but up the slope a little bit in the woods, closer to the tent.
Okay.
So it's like he ran from the tent in a different direction. When he hit the wood line, he stopped.
Mm.
Okay. Just like I said, it gets confusing. DeLove was on his back. One hand was clinging to an undersized birch tree branch, while the other hand, locked in ice and rigor mortis, appeared to be protecting his head from some unknown assailant.
Wow.
So he died, almost looks like he's holding onto this little tree like he's pulling himself through the forest. He has his hand on the back of his head, like trying to protect his head from getting hit.
Yeah.
And he still got hit. Maybe. That's what it looks like when they find his corpse.
So whatever he got killed by didn't, like, take his body.
So half buried in the snow not far from the tent were the bodies of Rustem. The body of Rustem, which rescuers found laying face down in the snow. Sordum's skull bore a deep fracture nearly 7 inches long.
Dang.
Nevertheless, medical examiner experts later determined the most likely cause of death was hypothermia.
Not the giant blow to his skull.
He probably passed out from that, laid in the snow, and died.
Wow.
Of hypothermia, which only compounded the befuddlement of the volunteers and military search participants.
Man.
So we got four of them so far.
Yeah. Found four bodies. None of them eaten or taken yet.
But Rustem had a 9-inch long gash.
Seven-inch
long gash in the back of his head.
Yeah.
And DeLove himself looked like something was trying to beat him to death in the back of the head.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Died mid-run.
Maybe, what if it was just a rogue skier?
You're not the first one to suggest something of that nature.
Mm.
So, I guess, we'll take an ad break before we continue.
Okay.
Ready for this?
Yeah, I'm starving. Welcome to the latest episode of Cooking with Jay Clone 77. And today I'm joined by a special guest, the Veggie Man. Say hello, Veggie Man. So you've got a special treat for us today. You're going to be cooking a new veggie dish, a vegan dish for us today. And what do you got on the menu? Ooh, artichoke asparagus spread, eh? Yeah, I don't particularly like this, but I'm going to go on out on a limb and give it a try. Oh my goodness. It's delicious. What's the secret ingredient?
Zerp, zerp.
Flavors of the forest Bigfoot breath? Raw garlic dust? Wow. They freeze dry the highest quality of ingredients raw to capture the flavor you won't find in stores? Wow. Thank you, Veggie Man. I'm going to add this to my kitchen. That's Bigfoot breath by Flavors of the Forest. You can get yours at flavorsforest.com, and you can cook flavorsforest.com/corn, and you can cook just like the Veggie Man.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
That Veggie Man. He's a great cook.
Do you think these guys would have all died if they had Flavors of the Forest?
No. They would have, I'm telling you, that horseradish, they could have just thrown that pocket sanded it right in their faces.
Pocket sand.
Whatever this creature thing was, whether it's human, creature, or even an elemental.
Back to the search for carcasses.
Yes. So we found 4 so far.
The carcass of Xander turned up the furthest away from the group. Traces of blood were found near her corpse. Yet it was not revealed if she was the source, although the conclusion would seem likely. The rescuers could not understand why there was no evidence of a struggle. I'll re-say this.
Mm-hmm.
So Xander, or Zandaya, or however you say her, this, it's Russian. Traces of blood were found near her corpse. They did not know if it was her blood. She did not have any extremely obvious wounds or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like it was. There was no evidence of a struggle. She was just laying there dead and blood kind of around.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Odd.
And it was the furthest away.
She was the furthest. She made it a long distance away.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard kind of different accounts on that, how far it actually was.
Mm-hmm.
But a long time. She ran for a while and then died.
Until she couldn't. Until she stopped.
The party continued their efforts to locate the rest of them, but the lengthy search for the remaining members turned up nothing. The men on the site could not comprehend why the group of extremely experienced hikers would dash half-naked into the bitter cold of the forest, into the black of the night. Nor could they fathom what kind of terror must have inspired these young people to act so recklessly. Yeah, so you imagine being the rescuers
and coming across
and
this?
And knowing that these are advanced people in this field. In finding all this stuff after through a couple days, and they're like, there's a demon out here. It's not normal.
Right. I mean, I'm just trying to put the pieces together right here in this room. I can't imagine being there in person, finding it, and then trying to do that on top of it. I don't know. I don't even know what I would think. This is a weird one, though. But trying to put this puzzle piece together, I don't know.
Would it amaze you if I told you I've had it figured out?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me.
I don't.
Okay.
I have some ideas that I believe may be true.
Okay, well, maybe from those, I'll be able to figure it out.
Yeah, but I'm not, there's nowhere in this that I would be like betting everything on that this is what happened.
Gotcha, okay.
Just because there's so many odd ends, and you gotta, it feels like no matter which conclusion you pick,
something will contradict
you
it.
You have to leave out some kind of data.
Yeah, to make that make sense.
Yeah. So they continued, they couldn't figure it out. Even more perplexing was the fact that the searchers, after inspecting for the severely damaged tent, came to the conclusion that it was cut from the inside, as if the occupants were trying to frantically escape something that was already sealed in the tent with them, or were in such a rush to unclass the tent, they just had to get out.
Hmm.
So those are kind of the two thoughts that the first group of rescuers are like, after they examined the tent.
Yeah.
They're like, they had to either get out of the tent so fast because something was already in the tent with them, or that something was happening and they just couldn't deal with unzipping the tent.
What if, like, one of them pranked the other ones and he had, you know, like the little fart bomb things? So he just unzipped the tent, squeezed it, and threw it in there.
And they all died?
Well, they're all like, it pops, so now they're stuck in there. So they're all like, and he's holding the, you know, the zipper flap closed so they can unzip
way
it
out.
So they're all mad and they cut out and they all come scrambling out and they're all like, what are you doing? And he's like laughing, but then they're all like mad and they're yelling at him, and as they're yelling at him, they all like pause and freeze as he's still like giggling. So he's like, what? And then he turns around, and then that's when whatever it is just like standing there, and then they all run and scramble, and then this guy gets thrown into a tree.
I mean, that's not the most ridiculous one I've ever heard for this.
It would be funny, though. Not funny as in...
I know what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So amidst
the broken woods, yeah, shredded canvas, and debris of the ravaged tent, investigators discovered rolls of undeveloped film from the journeys of the few expedition members. But rather than helping illuminate the truth, this find would only add more and more layers to the mystery.
Yep, absolutely.
And I highly suggest everybody pull up these photos.
Yeah, they're very public. Because
this was months. They did this for months.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were...
In and out, like the ski adventure.
Gotcha.
They'd get to a town, they'd stop, and then they'd do the next 50 miles.
Gotcha.
So after 2 months of fruitless searching, so there's actually a picture of the the search party on my birthday, May 4th in 1959.
Wow.
Was one of the big pushes because it was like, it was not spring. You look at the pictures, it's still like feet and feet and feet of snow.
Right, right.
But it was kind of the time where they were like, okay, it's melting a little bit. Maybe some evidence will be uncovered.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably not storming as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After two fruitless months of searching, the spring thaw finally let the weather up enough to reveal the corpses of the missing team members in a ravine situated some 225 feet from the pines that served as the arboreal memorial of the first two men with a fire.
Okay.
So they were only 225 feet away from the giant pine tree where the two guys had basically died of exposure after bloodying their hands.
Right.
So there's four people in this pit. So the lost four were the instructor Alexander, the engineer Nicholas, and the student Alexander. So there's two Alexanders and Ludema. Were discovered buried beneath 12 feet of snow and ice.
Dang.
All had apparently succumbed to brutal internal injuries.
Hmm.
So these four people are in a ravine, and they all died from extremely brutal internal organ failure.
Like they got beat up or fallen from a great distance?
Either way.
Yeah.
Something really bad happened.
Some physical trauma without being sharp.
Unlike their friends who had perished above, these victims were fully dressed.
Okay.
So The other, no, pretty much everybody else was naked. The first five were naked. These four were fully dressed.
Hmm.
They were all in the tent.
Hmm. So they were all in their own tent.
In one big tent.
Yeah. Oh, these guys weren't in that. They were in the tent that got ripped open?
Yes.
Oh, so they were in
there
too. That's
where they would have been sleeping, yes.
But they were dressed.
They were fully dressed. Huh. And they died of internal injury, severe internal injury.
Huh.
The five that were scattered through the forest had died of exposure. D-Love himself was hit in the head. And so the other guy died of exposure, but had a 7-inch cut through the back of his head.
Huh.
That's odd.
Yeah. It almost is making me think more now, like abduction kind of scenario.
We'll get to that.
Because if they're clothed and the ones aren't unclothed, I imagine, you know, when you get supposedly taken, you know, you're usually, you either come, when you awake and things are odd, you either are naked or your clothes are on wrong. You know, that's, mm-hmm. But either way, your clothes have been removed. So if it's some of them are abducted, what if they were in mid abduction and someone woke up and it freaked everything out and they got dropped? Maybe they were in the whole tent and the whole thing got lifted up like 50 feet and then dropped. And these are the ones on the bottom that got smashed and everyone else just scrambled out.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Could be. As the cases of Sodom, Turek's and burning skulls showed evidence of having been struck by an extremely heavy object. So four of the nine had been hit in the back of the head with something extremely heavy and dense.
Hmm.
Zoltan and Duman's chest had been crushed inward.
Dang.
Shattering ribs and causing massive internal damage instantly. Almost like if you pick a child up and you just like you put your hand on their back and their chest and just squeezed.
Dang.
That's kind of what their injuries look like.
That's extremely graphic and brutal.
It's what happened. We'll have to put a warning on this one.
Right, yeah.
Strangely, there was no indications of what may have caused the severe trauma. And even more bizarrely, the corpses showed no signs of bruising or soft tissue damage.
Hmm.
So their organs and bones were exploded, but the outside protective layers were fine.
What the heck?
Can you think of anything that damages internally and not externally?
Sound?
Hmm. So Dr. Boris...
Is that where you were hinting at?
Maybe.
Okay.
Dr. Boris Volsamandani, who inspected the bodies, stated that the force of these corpses that were hit exceeded the capabilities of any man.
Well...
And were claimed that the damage was equal to the effects of being hit by a car.
Okay.
So all he was saying was... This wasn't a human did this.
Right. No one's punching them.
Swinging an axe or anything like
right,
that.
Right, right.
The human body can't expel that much force to do this kind of damage. It would be like they laid in front of a car and got hit going 45.
Right. Which I'm still even thinking more of the dropped.
Now, it could be dropped. He just was saying equivalently.
Right, yeah.
How much damage was done internally was not, because you'll see fingers start getting pointed here very soon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's not Ivan over there punching these people out and breaking their ribs. What if, though, too, the cold temperature, like it was so cold, it made it so there was no bruising or nothing like that. You know what I mean?
Sure. I'm not a medical expert. Right. I don't know.
Just a thought. Like, let's say if some big object, like a...
I was getting at sound and microwaves.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know if, like, some big blunt object did hit and crush them. Normally, you know, typically it would bruise and leave big blunt force trauma on their surface. But what if it was just so cold? You know, when they died, their body just froze instantly. It never gave a chance for the blood to move around in the body to bruise.
Could be. I don't know that.
I don't know.
I don't know if that's possible, and I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either. But it sounds like it is.
Sounds good.
You're right, exactly. That's all I count everything on.
The searchers were startled to observe that Dolman's head had been tilted back, her stretched mouth wide, and as if she was emitting a silent scream in the moment of her death.
Gosh, so probably she's was. Like, right, know. Yeah.
Up close upon inspection, the rescuers realized her tongue had been ripped out by the root of the muscle.
Ugh.
So something with great force had went in there and ripped the tongue out by the root.
I'm telling you, this is getting more and more like abduction-y.
So you started at Bigfoot, and so far you're at abduction.
Right now, I think so, yeah.
You're not the only one. We'll get to aliens.
Because
That's a big part of this.
Yeah. Whatever aliens are.
Yeah, whatever, you know, just...
Yeah.
They also noted that at some point, these poor individuals either exchanged or stole clothes off their comrades as her foot was swaddled in tattered pieces of Korkazal's wool pants, and Zoltar was found wearing Dunham's flax fur hat and coat. So are they found pieces of other people's clothes, or they stole pieces from other people's clothes that were the naked guys?
Yeah.
And then their chest exploded?
Huh. Yeah, that's good. That would be... Now, if we could figure out in which order that happened, that would help a lot trying to solve
another
this.
Thing suggested with that is that when they were... If they all ran out of the tent, they just grabbed whatever they could.
Yeah.
They did not care whose is what.
That's very reasonable. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't care if it's your coat or not.
No, yeah, it's warm.
I'm in my underwear, and it's negative 18 out here.
I'm grabbing this.
And there's a behemoth out here trying to eat us.
Potentially.
The searchers were also unsure of the result of dressing too swiftly in the dark tent, like I just said, or scavenging articles of clothing from deceased teammates. And there's even some suggested that they even maybe undressed the dead bodies. They went through the woods.
And clothed themselves.
So, some of the people that died from exposure, they may have, you know, just grabbed things. Maybe nothing nefarious happened.
Like they were already dead.
Yeah, they found, you know, Ted dead. They took his jacket.
Right, you don't need it no more.
He's dead.
Right.
You know, he's a friend, but I'm freezing to death, and he's already frozen to death.
Until they took his jacket. Hey!
Stop.
Yeah, he's too cold to say anything. Yeah, they just shush him.
At the funerals...
You're dead.
...that soon followed the discovery of bodies, many family members claimed that the skin of the deceased bore a lubricant, unnatural orange color. And even more disturbingly, most reports insisted that the hair had lost its pigment, and almost everybody's hair was a dull shade of gray. Skeptics claim that the orange skin was caused by exposure, and I'll come back to that, and that their hair had not lost its color, but it was interesting that so many people really, really repeated this and took notice of these strange features. Like, a bunch of the relatives wrote this down privately.
That
they had gray hair and the orange skin. So when, like...
To everybody in the group that was found?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, exposure, I've never seen, like, super bright orange. I've seen corpses and living people that have had extreme exposure events.
Yeah.
That have a yellow or a pink or a red hue to their skin. Basically, the fat and some of the tissues in your face, specifically, will start freezing. And it'll burst the cells.
Ooh.
And, I mean, not being too weird or graphic or whatever, but, you know, calluses on feet specifically.
Yeah.
They turn orange.
Yeah, that orangey-yellowy, yeah. Yep.
So this kind of busted skin tissues from exposure will do the same thing.
Okay.
But I've never seen it like, some people are describing like an orange. That's like that, like you just said, a tan, orange, yellow, you know, the callus color.
Yeah, I could see that, yeah.
But this was, some people were claiming it was much more vibrant.
And we don't know the effects of what freezing can do to a burst, you know, adipose tissue. We don't know.
Oh, they know. These are not the first people to freeze death on this mountain.
Oh, okay.
It's just the weirdest one.
They know, yes. We don't.
Yeah. And then the grayed hair, I've seen people say left, right, center that it is, you know, caused by freezing to death exposure. I've had, as a man personally, that's had chunks of my hair freeze and break off.
Yeah.
I'd never grayed from that. It was still the same color and it was frozen. My hair was actually, everybody at home, my hair was actually frozen to the core.
Yeah.
And it maintained the same color. Because hair is not really alive.
No.
Except at the root and stuff like that.
It's like your fingernail.
Yeah. Or it's tissues that are made, hard tissues that are made. And then, you know, pushed out of the skin.
Right.
So, I don't know. But there's many other things that can cause orange. Anything from microwave exposure. to gamma rays, to radiations of other types. And then that can also cause gray hair. That'll just bleach your hair.
Radiation.
All those things. Extreme sound weapons.
Yes.
Sonic booms can cause some of this because it causes cells to rupture.
Now, is there anything that can cause like your hair to, you know, grow back?
Hmm?
Anything that can cause your hair to grow back?
The right doses of radiation.
Hmm. All right. Google radiation doses. All right, we're good.
There we go. Okay. So far, extremely odd stuff.
Yeah.
And these people, the first time I ever watched, or first time I ever heard this was on Blurry Photos podcast with David Flora and the other David.
Okay.
Love the podcast. Love those guys. I've talked to David Flora through online means before. And I've been enamored with this case because this is like my opinions on Bigfoot. If you ask me any given day what I think happened at the DeLove Pass incident, I will probably give you a different answer.
It's shifting.
Because there are so many people that have done, you know, so much research and on-ground investigations and talking to, I mean, it's hard now, but, well, you know, forever they were talking to live relatives. They were talking to people in the town.
Right.
And we haven't even got to the natives yet, the native peoples of this area.
Mm.
So I'll finish this little bit. And we'll get to some investigation, and then the next episode will be all about what could have caused this, what may have happened.
Okay.
But let me finish this little bit, and we'll kind of end it here. As if all of this wasn't odd enough, some articles of clothing found on the bodies measured to be emitting extremely higher levels of radiation than normal.
Ooh, okay.
Now, that phrasing was put out several times, and I don't know. I've seen people say it was only three times higher than background radiation, which is not unheard of, right? Because coal is radioactive.
Right.
There's stuff that's radioactive that you can just grab on accident. Like you can rub against some of this stuff, like you're hiking, right? You can rub against some of this stuff and
bring it along with you.
And you could be three times higher than background radiation.
But is that enough to be significantly like change anything?
No, it's not damaging to you.
Okay.
It's like a banana or a group of bananas. You know, bananas are slightly radioactive.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, fair. Like if you take a Geiger counter, a sensitive Geiger counter to like Walmart or whatever, and you wave them over the bananas, it'll bounce, but it's not a dangerous level whatsoever.
Wow. Didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, I've had big Geiger counters, and I've seen dangerous levels of radiation.
Oh, yeah. Certain rivers.
And certain big rivers that have states in the name.
Right.
Shouldn't eat fish out of.
I thought you were shushing me for a second.
Oh, no.
You're saying shush, or shouldn't.
No, it shouldn't be. I mean, it's a high river.
okay. I thought we were dancing around it.
I thought we were too, but
no, you said it.
Don't eat. I wouldn't eat fish out of the Ohio River.
No, just don't. It's the Ohio River is highly radioactive. Yeah,
not, it's the Ohio River is not highly radioactive.
Okay, pockets of the Ohio River have highly radioactive pockets within it.
Yeah, there's holes in the bottom of the river that have radioactive deposits.
It's more specific.
So yeah, higher levels of radiation. I've seen people say it's 11,000 times, and I've seen people say it was only four times higher.
Yeah, those are two very different numbers, though.
And some of this may come with a cover-up that happens.
Oh.
To where let's say it was 11,000 times.
Then they just say it's four.
No, it was only four. Guys, it was only four.
Okay.
Or vice versa.
Okay.
I don't know. Like I'm saying, there's weirdness, and then there's all kinds of stuff. This case is extremely hard to follow, and the Soviet Union government at the time after made it extremely hard to ever research again.
Mm-hmm.
So the investigation. People start, you know, obviously looking into it, trying to figure out what happened to these people. So compounding enigmas surrounding this fascinating case, combined with the youth and popularity of the victims, sent the Soviet investigation into overdrive. These guys were kind of famous in the Soviet Union at this time. They weren't like A-list celebrities or anything like that, but they were known. And then the case blew up. So the Soviet Union wanted this to go away now. Yeah. So they wanted to find out what happened.
Okay.
Quote, is what they said.
Okay.
So the first thing they did was try to reconstruct the series of events at the DeLove ski team's shocking demise to help the journeys and film roles discovered on the scene. The primary mystery that faced the team and his team were chosen to make camp on an exposed mountain face when a detour of less than a quarter of a mile would have afforded them so much more shelter from the harsh Russian winter elements.
Okay.
So that was what I said earlier, like an hour ago.
Yeah.
They picked a spot on the middle of an exposed snow slope, which is dangerous for like avalanches and that kind of stuff. These yeah. people knew that.
Mm-hmm.
They chose to put their tent dead in the middle of it, as far away from all the woods as they could pick.
Mm.
When every other ski explorer, all these other people like...
would not do that.
They were like, no, they should have put it in the forest. There's, right. there's this, and this spot that are a quarter mile away that would have made amazing campsites. It'd have been 40 degrees warmer.
Mm.
So they, in my opinion, this is me talking now, they chose that spot for some reason.
Right.
Something out of the ordinary. I don't know how soon the paranormal happenings happened to these people.
Yeah.
If it was the whole trip in, you know, something's following them for a week, like some people suggest. And they're like, well, we don't want to, you know, we want to have our edges so we can watch if anything's coming up on us.
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know. But this, I do know, is they picked that spot for a reason.
Something compelled them to stop
there. They ignored dangers of that spot because it outweighed dangers of something else.
Okay.
That's okay. The primary mystery. Oh, sorry, I already said that. Sorry. It would be Yadin, the only team member to survive thanks to his timely illness, who would shed some light on this question. So D-Love probably did not want to lose the distance that he had covered or decided to practice, to actually practice camping on a mountain slope.
Hmm.
So that's what the team member that lived said, that maybe he didn't want to go back a quarter mile. Or ahead, you know, they just stuck there. Or maybe that, because they were like, several of these people are getting ready to be certified for like basically mountain exploring guides.
Okay.
So maybe they decided that, hey, we need to practice because even though there's woods right there, that may not be the option everywhere.
Right. What if yeah. we have to do this?
So let's take time and let's do this and practice this skill.
See how bad it sucks.
Yeah.
If you get stuck out here like this.
Yeah. I don't know. He may be right. You may be wrong. I really don't know.
With them all being in one tent, though, and on that slope, do you think maybe they could have got caught in like some nasty weather, like right there, and they just had to stop and set up camp or they were going to die?
The blizzard explanation is one of the big ones we'll cover next episode.
Okay.
But yes, that is kind of a thought.
Okay.
Is that a quarter mile may have been impossible.
Yeah. I mean, you've been stuck in a blizzard on a lake, and you can't see 10 feet in front of you.
I got stuck in heavy, like, machinery.
Right, yeah.
With let alone walking.
A four-wheeler, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can. If you get caught off guard, it snowed 18 inches that day in 2 hours.
Dang. Yeah, it happened real fast.
And we were only, we had went 10 miles out, but we were, like, a quarter mile from an island.
Yeah.
Couldn't see it.
Yeah, exactly.
I knew there was other ice fishermen in our little area. Couldn't see them. We walked over before we left just to make sure they didn't need help getting out before we left.
Yeah.
Because we were in a group so we could help each other.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, you've been ice fishing with me. We always try to help out whoever. I'll cut anybody's holes they want.
Right.
But, yeah, so it can be winter is extremely beautiful and extremely unforgiving.
Ah.
These things... when they happen, these blizzards, these snowstorms, these wind storms, because that's another factor with this, specifically this area.
Uh-huh.
If they come up, they will kill you.
Oh, yeah.
They will kill you so fast. Even, like, people think Michigan's tame, right? And how many people we lose a year ice fishing? 4 to 5.
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because it's, and I tell people, you think it's tame because you can see your cabin?
Mm-hmm.
You go under that ice, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
It don't matter. No matter how tough. How strong of a swimmer you think you are.
Oh, yeah. Or how strong of a puncher you think you are.
You will die.
Yeah, you're not getting through that ice if you fall through a hole or fall through whatever, the ice.
And it's same with these back mountain, like the four-wheeler snowmobile trails my brother does.
Yeah.
You know, he does 150 miles in the UP sometimes.
Yeah.
And you help everybody you see broken down because if you're the last people they see in that night, they will freeze to death.
Oh, yeah.
If they don't get moving because they're 50 miles from the cabin.
Oh, yeah.
They have to go another 50 miles. So that's modern day, 70 years later, in places with roads and cars that you can drive to and get help.
Right.
And people freeze to death.
Yeah. We're talking 70 years before on a mountain slope with nothing.
Yeah. So some of the photos. So there's a photo with the group smiling. The photo develops from the roll found. The tent revealed that expedition members had set up camp on February 2nd at approximately 5 p.m. The slope of, you know, the Dead Man's Mountain in order to get out of inclement weather. And they surmise this from the photos.
Okay.
That they may have been using this slope. There may have been some factor where they were using it as like a windshield.
Mm.
So the group had cleared the tree line and was 10 miles from their first destination on their long track, Gorg Orton, which the photos all looked happy and healthy and jovial. So this is the day it happened.
Okay.
They looked fine.
Yeah.
Fine. Oh, sorry. No, this is February 2nd. This is weeks before it happened, I guess. Sorry. It is the day of.
No, yeah, because remember, it was the 28th.
Yeah.
Was when they were expected back, but it wasn't until the 11th that alarms were raised.
So investigators came to the conclusion that around 7 p.m., the team ate a meal, and not long thereafter, members began to settle down for the night. The temperatures on the slope was less than 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which I will say, that is cold.
Huh?
We're mammals, we're people, these are explorers, that's fine.
5 degrees Fahrenheit? Yeah. Yeah, it's not terrible. For someone that's in Ohio, that we range from 100 to negative 30.
Well, negative 40 or 38 was the coldest I've ever been. That's when my hair froze off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 40 something degrees warmer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we hit around freezing here. I mean, especially in the 30s and the 20s, it's not like terrible. I'm going to die. The only time it feels that way is if the wind's blowing. But if it's 5 degrees and there's no wind, I mean, it's bearable.
So which made the investigators wonder why so many of the skiers were in a state of undress. Because most of the time you sleep in your stuff.
Right, yeah.
You don't get naked. And we're going to put warnings for adult content on this episode anyways. But I want to say this, and I do not believe this whatsoever, but this has been suggested several times.
Yeah.
That they maybe were like mid-orgy or something of that nature.
Mm.
I do not think so. I really do not think so.
It's just that's sad from time to time.
Yes.
They could have been also like for body heat reasons. You know, you
have to sometimes. And I mean, you can like strip down to your underwear and just put skin to skin.
And it's warmer
to
then.
Survive.
Right.
You become like a bigger animal.
Yeah.
So why, like Bergman's rule, why do animals further away from the equator get bigger? Because the volume goes up less than the surface area. So you keep warmth in more efficiently.
Okay.
So humans, if you lay in a pile like that, your volume is going up and your surface area is going down relatively.
Right. That makes sense.
So you can produce and save more heat that way.
Right.
Just saying.
Yeah.
I just said the orgy thing because I've seen it said and I like to include
everything. We leave no stone unturned.
I, in the heart of my heart, do not believe that was happening.
I agree with you. We explore every corn kernel on the cob.
So whether the reasons have been, most researchers agree at this point, everything was relatively normal. 7 p.m. the night that all heck broke loose was normal.
Okay.
Forensic pathologists later estimated the events which ultimately led to the deaths of the skiers had occurred between 9:30 and 11:30 p.m. They base their speculations on undigested food found in the victim's stomachs, as well as some other conditions of the body.
Okay.
They kind of use that timeline of when food stopped being digested because they died.
Right.
Be like, okay, it's roughly this 2-hour window.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 to 4 hours after they had eaten dinner and went to bed. At this point, the military investigation began piecing the puzzle together to the best of their abilities. What follows is, in their best estimate, what occurred. So I'm going to read the military's. You know what? I'm not. We're going to come back. So when we come back next week, we're going to start with the military's explanation of the tragic timeline.
Oh, this will be great.
The Soviet Union and what they say, this is what happened. Trust me, I'm the Soviet Union.
Let's see how similar they are to our ruling forces.
I think the same-ish.
Probably.
Different accent.
Yes.
So far, I mean, what do you think?
I still don't know. Well, I always thought, because I knew the story, but I never knew the great details of this story. And I've seen the photos and that one, but I've always thought it was just a creature. But now I'm just a little, I guess, open-minded to something else happening going on.
A lot of, so when we come back, a lot of finger pointing starts happening.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because I'll give you a little foreshadowing. The parents don't like what's about to be said.
Yeah.
And their surviving friend don't like what's about to be said.
Yep.
And they don't shut up about it.
And then what happens to them?
It's Soviet Union, so.
Oh.
They take a vacation.
Same thing that happens here.
Yeah, they take a vacation. To Wyoming. With all the rare earth elements.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah, so they start making a stink about it. This gets weird. They start blaming. You won't even believe what this thing gets blamed on. But I'm like you. When I first just kind of knew about it, right? I was a Bigfoot, Yeti, Ural, whatever. You know, Yaren. Wherever this, you know, it'd be the Yaren.
Would it be? Yeah, I guess you're right.
For Russia?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's the same animal, roughly.
Right, yeah.
But it would be the Yaren.
Okay.
Would it be their version? Yeti is, you know, that we throw that around for mountains.
Like Himalayas. Yeah. And yeah.
But that's probably thousands of miles away.
Okay, fair.
I don't know that off the top of my head, though, but I'm going to say it because that's the bottom of Asia.
As the crow flies?
Yeah, it's the bottom of Asia, and this is the top of Asia.
Eastern Europe? Yeah, I mean, a hop, skip, and a jump. Let's just leave it at that.
At least hundreds of miles.
Yeah. Either way. All right.
Anyways, I was, it was a monster.
Right.
This is a monster. This is a Bigfoot-ish animal thing. And I was even a bear person for a while. This was, so bears waking up out of hibernation, they're extremely dangerous.
Extremely aggressive.
In Alaska, they call them death bears.
Yeah.
Because most time they die, the bears do, because they wake up way too early. Their digestive system's all out of whack, and they will just kill and kill and kill.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll that one lady, the Alaskan bush people. No, Alaska, The Last Frontier is the TV show. It's the one lady, I love her to death. She lives by herself. I can't remember her name.
Sue Aiken?
Is that her?
The one that got attacked by a bear and went back, crawled back, grabbed her gun, crawled back out and found it and shot it and killed it?
Yes, that lady.
Sue Aiken.
The homesteader out by herself.
Oh, she's awesome.
I'd love to meet her one day.
Me too. Maybe we should invite her to the Jamboree.
I was going to say the homesteading conference.
Oh, yeah.
So she shared a story of a death bear that was actively ripping its way into her cabin with her inside.
Oh, my gosh.
And she just had the rifle pointed at the hole it was making.
Yeah.
She's like, the second I was going to see eyes,
bam,
I'm just going to start shooting.
Yeah.
But it was literally ripping her cabin apart to get her.
Gosh.
And then it stopped and started running. And when she looked out the window, a pack of wolves had started harassing it. And they killed it and ate it on her runway.
Oh, wow.
Because the wolves know that the bear is like at the borderline exhaustion.
Yeah.
Because that's why they're nuts, is because they're starving to death.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the wolves take advantage of it. And they know just a little bit of work, They can finish running them out of energy.
Oh,
and
my just eat gosh, them. Yeah.
And she's like, the wolves never bothered me. I just stayed in until they were done.
Thank you, wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, a dangerous bear. But, have you already said earlier this episode, if a bear kills a person, let alone nine...
There'd be some evidence.
There'd be exploded corpses.
Right. Yeah. There'd be a sign or two that says, oh, a bear was here.
Now, I will say some of the blunt force trauma to the back of the head do kind of match bear, big brown bear claws. But it was just one claw.
So it's a single clawed bear that has no intent to eat, just only intent to kill.
Or a weapon made out of bear.
What?
So... If you had it right now, before we get into next week's episode with the investigations, the weirdness and all that that comes with that side of it, and then the explanations.
Yeah.
Where would you put your money right now?
On what's going on?
What happened to these people?
I'm thinking alien abduction. That's what I think.
I'm not saying you're wrong.
Yeah.
I think when we get into the next week's stuff, that is a high probability.
That's what I'm thinking.
That's a lot of people say it or some kind of thing.
Yeah. What about you?
I don't want to, I know the rest of it, so I don't,
right.
I don't want to show my hand.
Right.
But the ideas you've brought forward have been, all of them, even, you know, the quote unquote goofier ones, have been brought forward, and I don't really think.
Even the fart bomb one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
No, so that one, the closest thing to that was their kitchen, like their little fire stove,
leaked?
Blew up.
Ooh.
And they had to get out because they were on fire.
Ooh, gosh. Okay.
So that was why they, some of them were dressed, some of them weren't. And they panicked and had to get out.
Cut themselves out and ran, on fire. Ooh, that'd be bad.
Because it's like gel.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh.
It's napalm. It's napalm. So you have liquid fire sticking to things in there. So they may have stripped off their clothes because it was on fire.
Ooh, not good.
But that was the closest thing to the, like,
okay,
the goofy bomb. Stink bomb. But, something happened inside, so we all had to get out.
Right, yeah.
All of it is, possible. I really don't think anybody...
Who knows?
Anything is possible.
Yeah.
All right, we'll come back next week with more of this. I've been the Great and Powerful Mystery.
And I've been J-Clone 100.
We'll catch you next week.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Cribbins the Corn Podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the J-Clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on CryptidsOfTheCorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye! Bye.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.